The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Fact-muting from your manuscript and book collection. This program is a partnership between the National Park Service, the Lawyers Committee for Cultural Heritage Preservation, and the Washington School of Law. I am currently with the National Park Service, and I head up a program called the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. It's in your gold book, but the only point I want to make with regard to that is that once upon a time I was a judge, but I've always been a cultural property lawyer, and that after leaving the bench found full-time life and happiness as a cultural property lawyer. And that's the basis of the Lawyers Committee for Cultural Heritage Preservation. It's using the law to preserve cultural heritage, the non-renewable resources that define who we are as a people and make us whole. And we hope that you will find an enterprising career in this field, at least if not on a full-time basis, on a part-time basis, because it's what has really brought richness to our feelings as practitioners and our ability to make a contribution in general to society. I want to tell you that on behalf of the Park Service, with me here tonight is David Tarler sitting in the front row, and with him Bob Palmer. And Bob is our investigator of cultural resource matters, and David, an attorney working in the NAGPRA division, and we do training on cultural heritage resource protection. So that brings us here tonight. As to the Lawyers Committee for Cultural Heritage Preservation, if anybody ever has a better name than LCCHP, let us know. We're wide open on that. Both David Tarler and myself are on the board of that organization, and we hope that other lawyers and law students will join us on that. That organization is not only geared to using the law for cultural heritage preservation, but also supporting the education of cultural heritage law, cultural resources law, in the law schools, and giving technical assistance to practitioners. And I want you to think of that in all of the aspects of cultural resources law. We're going to talk tonight about criminal law, but it embodies historic preservation, both on federal land, on state land, in tribal land, where they're hiring lawyers to establish cultural heritage laws and protection codes, in the marine environment, in the art market, in representing museums, and in the international context. Tonight we're going to focus on the domestic and international context and criminal laws, and look at looting of rare manuscripts and books from collections. This is an area that has gained in notoriety, theft from the Vatican, from the National Archives, and from other museums and treasure troves around the world. I want to call your attention, in the gold book, we have two ways of protecting these resources, these treasures, and one of them that will be mentioned tonight is the Archaeological Resources Protection Act, and it begins in your gold books on page 139, and the criminal provision you will find is 470EE, which begins on 144, and the section that will be talked about is Part C, what happens if it comes not off federal land, but from state or private lands, or as you will hear tonight, in the international context. The other law is not included in your gold books, but certainly by the time we do the next publication of this, we will probably include it, and that is a Title 18 offense, your criminal code, 668, and that is theft of major artwork. That specifically applies to artworks that are either 100 years old and worth over $5,000, or of any age and over $100,000. So to introduce tonight's speakers, I'll turn it over to Professor Fine.
My privilege to welcome you to the Washington College of Law at American University tonight, and I am indeed very thankful that you turned out given the weather. I think it was a wise decision because this is going to be a wonderful program. I think I can say on behalf of my law school that you could probably enter this room any evening of any day and find discussion of a very intriguing and cutting-edge topic with a panel of very distinguished speakers. But to my mind, you couldn't find a topic with more intrigue, more kind of cachet and interest. This is kind of almost Dan Brown-esque, you know. I think we could get a screenplay out of this panel, the stories that they'll tell us tonight. So I just want to thank on behalf of the law school the speakers for their generosity in sharing these presentations with us today, and I want to introduce you to them. We will first hear from Bonnie Magnus Gardner, who has a PhD in Near Eastern Archaeology. I'm just going to talk about her degree. I'm not going to talk about the others' degrees because they're just lawyers, but I just want to, and they didn't go to American University, so I'm not going to mention their law degrees. This is for my students in the audience, among other things that you'll learn, I think you'll learn from the lawyers on the panel, all the really interesting law jobs there in Washington, D.C., especially for students interested in art law. But I digress. Okay, Bonnie Magnus Gardner has taught archaeology at Bryn Mawr College. She was an archaeological program officer at the National Endowment for the Humanities and a program officer at the Library of Congress. For 8 years, she served as the cultural property analyst at the State Department and currently is the program manager of the Art Theft Program of the FBI. I'm going to introduce each of our speakers now so I don't have to get up again. All right, next we have Dennis Kennedy, who's retired from the federal government after 30 years of service. He was the Assistant U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia. He's also served as the Attorney Advisor in the Office of Legislative and Governmental Affairs in the U.S. Department of Justice. And for the past 18 years, he's lectured on criminal law matters, including cultural property and heritage resource protection for the Departments of Justice, the Interior, Defense, Homeland Security, Health and Human Services, Agriculture, and Treasury. We have a duo combination for our last presentation. First, we'll hear from Sarah Chaffin, who has been a lawyer as a litigation associate in many distinguished law firms, most recently at Proskauer Rose here in the Washington, D.C. office. She was appointed an assistant U.S. attorney in 1998, and she served in the appellate division, the domestic violence and misdemeanors, general felony and grand jury selections of the Superior Court Division, and the organized crime and narcotics trafficking section of the criminal division. Sarah joined the fraud and public corruption section of the office as a senior assistant United States attorney in June 2003. Her work in the section has focused on a variety of white-collar offenses, including anti-kickback violations, healthcare fraud violations, and insurance fraud violations. And finally, we have Kelly Multiati. Is that good? Okay. Okay, she, during the investigation that she'll talk about, she was the Acting Assistant Inspector General for Investigations, and she was the case agent. She's been a special agent with the National Archives and Records Administration, Office of Inspector General, since May of 2003. She served as in the enforcement arena for many years, working for the U.S. Customs Service, the Drug Enforcement Administration, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, and the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve. I might also say that this is just a fascinating group of panelists on administrative law and all the various agencies in our government. Again, I want to thank the panelists for their service, but we're going to really put them to work because after their presentations, we're going to expect to hear questions from you. So if you could just hold your questions until after the presentations, we're going to be happy to hear from you. Okay. Thank you.
I'm Bonnie Gardner, Magnus Gardner, as I've been introduced, and I'm here to speak on stealing history book and manuscript theft as from the FBI perspective. So I'll be talking about some cases and then some issues in prevention in libraries and other institutions that hold manuscripts. But before I start, I just wanted to give you a little bit of advice, career counseling, as I saw downstairs as I was coming in the building. It's career counseling day. And one of the things I'd like to suggest is that you seriously consider a position as legal counsel in a university or college or a museum. I know people who are legal counsel in all of those positions who have fascinating problems to deal with and a life on campus or in an institution that's varied and academic and scholarly as well as interesting. The other option I'd like to think about would be becoming an intern perhaps at the State Department or even at the FBI. I know we have an intern position, and I had several interns from law schools when I was at the State Department in the Cultural Property Office, and that is also a possibility too. And you can look into that by going to the State Department website, and there's a big internship button you can push, and it'll take you through the whole process of applying for such an internship. I would also suggest you have to call the Cultural Property Office as well and see if they have anything special coming up and or a special need that they might want you to target certain skills when you submit your application. Okay. So let's take a look at this. Right. As I'm sure many of you know, that the art antiquities, cultural property generally is a multi-billion-dollar industry worldwide. And New York and the United States generally is a major market center for both legitimate and illegitimate sales of antiquities and other forms of cultural property, books and manuscripts as well. These often involve, the criminal aspects of this often involve multinational groups. They cross many boundaries. They don't necessarily specialize in art. There are gangs in Europe that specialize in art theft, but in the United States they tend to be general criminal gangs willing to steal anything. And this involves kidnapping, robbery, extortion, murder, and we believe sometimes terrorism as well, as this may be a means of financing it. What I'm going to talk about here will address certain art theft issues, particularly in manuscripts and book theft and map theft as well, using case studies to look at specific points. Now, as was explained, I'm not a lawyer, and I do work for the FBI, and we investigate cases that generally we hope to be prosecuted and that the criminals involved would then be punished and sent to jail and repent, of course, and not do this again. But one of the things that I'm going to stress in giving this presentation and looking at these case studies is prevention, because although it's very important to identify people who are criminals and prosecute them for their crimes, it is even more important to learn from their activities how these institutions can prevent this from happening in the future and how they should behave if such a crime happens within their institution. I'm going to start out with a very historical case, a very unusual case, but it actually illustrates some of the techniques that the FBI uses in both in investigating and bringing these crimes to justice. Well, this one hasn't quite finished yet. It's getting pretty close. Now, this is a case of looting and repatriation. And this is the return of the North Carolina Bill of Rights to North Carolina. Early in 2003, this is a copy of the Bill of Rights. There are only 14 of these, by the way, and this is one of them. Early in 2003, the FBI learned that the National Constitution Center reported that one of the 14 original copies of the Bill of Rights had been offered for sale. As they authenticated the document, the NCC, the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia, determined that this was the copy made for the state of Carolina in 1789. This particular document had been stolen from a case in the Capitol. in 1865 by one of General William Tecumseh Sherman's Union soldiers during the Civil War. This was a soldier on his way home from raiding Atlanta. Unlike other more straightforward cases, the circumstances of the original theft led to an unusual legal fight to return the document to its original owner, that is, the state of North Carolina. This particular soldier in Sherman's army had been looting, as I said, on his way home. And under an 1862 order by Abraham Lincoln outlawing looting, the act of looting during wartime still constitutes theft. Yet one of the current claimants to this particular document maintains that the Bill of Rights was legal war booty that was taken by a soldier in action, taken from a state that had seceded from the Union, thus was not subject to Abraham Lincoln's edict at the time, and lost any protections it had had during that period. This particular argument is still under discussion, but as you can see, the document has actually gone home. Various owners had tried to sell this document back to the state of North Carolina over the years. The original soldier who looted it sold it very quickly within a few years to another family in New England, and they approached the state of North Carolina in 1897 and tried to sell it back to them, and again in 1925, the same family, it had been passed down. In both instances, North Carolina took the principled stance that it would refuse to purchase its own property. Now, they never saw the property itself, of course. This was done by letter, and therefore they couldn't seize it. It never actually went into North Carolina. The Bill of Rights surfaced once again just a few years ago, 2003, in the possession of an antiques dealer affiliated with the Antiques Roadshow and an entrepreneur under joint ownership. Through a third party, they offered it to the National Constitution Center, who authenticated it, and the National Constitution Center then informed the FBI of the offer, and they set up a sting. This is one of the things that we do best. So after inspecting a cashier's check for $4 million, the go-between was slightly taken aback when the FBI agents approached and, in fact, took away the document, took away the Bill of Rights, and they didn't take him into custody because he was just a go-between, but they took it into custody, pending the outcome of various claims to the document. Now, that was in 2003, and in early August 2005, the document was formally returned to North Carolina in a very nice ceremony, following a federal court decision to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. And I know it's going to be appealed again in some fashion, but this was enough to allow it to go back to North Carolina, and now that North Carolina has it, I imagine it will stay there. This is a rather unusual circumstance. This is definitely not the normal thing to happen. There are only 14 of these Bill of Rights, so I don't expect another one to turn up anywhere, and looting is probably not going to be an issue. Looting during wartime is not going to be an issue in the United States, but it may be elsewhere in the world, and it's worth thinking about what happens when soldiers take things during times of war. Now, theft from libraries and archives are a real subject here. From my point of view, it's not so much how you prosecute these, but who are these thieves? What are the circumstances of the theft? And what can we learn in the circumstances of the theft and the nature of the thieves that would help these institutions improve their security and prevent these kinds of losses or retrieve the materials that have been lost? Now, sometimes these thieves are internal. In fact, most of them are either internal or known to these libraries or institutions. They might be scholars or researchers or students, or they might even be staff, as we will see, or they might be somehow associated with the field in a seemingly legitimate way, but then conducting illicit activities at the same time. Then again, you also have the professional thief who will steal anything that's not nailed down. We have both. So the first case is Gilbert Joseph Land, Jr. I like to say of him, have exacto, will travel, because he liked to cut maps out of books. And this is a popular thing to do. Why is that? Well, in the last 10, 20 years perhaps, the value of maps, archival materials, rare books has really gone up. And the knowledge of the value of these objects has also been disseminated very widely through the media, through television shows, and through increasing knowledge of these kinds of activities. In this particular case, on December 7, 1995, Joseph Gilbert Bland, Jr. was detained by security officers in Johns Hopkins University Library in Baltimore after a librarian had observed him doing some suspicious things. She saw him fiddling with books, with valuable maps and other prints in them that would be very valuable, and she got very suspicious. She called security, and the security officers, the library officers, confronted Bland in the library, but he just gathered up all his stuff and he ran out the door with the security officers in pursuit. So they ran, if you know Baltimore, this is easy to imagine, so he ran down the street and towards the Walters Art Gallery, where they cornered him on one of the loading docks. And as he was running, there were hedges and things going down towards the Walters. He dumped his notebooks in the hedge to try and get rid of them. So they cornered him at the Walters and asked what he was doing and, you know, what this was all about. And he at that point, he admitted his name, because he'd entered the library under an alias. He provided document, University of Florida student ID under the name of James Perry. And then when they confronted him, he admitted his name was Gilbert Joseph Bland, Jr. He's actually a map dealer. Now, when they went and picked up those documents, he discarded the notebook. They found within the notebook three maps that had been removed from the rare book that he'd been consulting. And these maps were valued at about $2,000. Now, they took that, and within that notebook, there was also a list of libraries and other rare maps. So they took that list and, of course, took it to all of those libraries and said, are you missing something? And at the same time, they had Bland give the officers a list of the things that he stole. So once the University of Virginia, for example, was on that list, and again under the name of James Perry, he stole maps from Virginia that were valued at more than $5,000. He also stole 13 maps from the Regenstein Library in Chicago, which is kind of curious because the Regenstein collection room is actually all glass, and you can't bring in briefcases or pens or anything else. So that's a pretty good security situation. But somehow he managed to sneak out these 13 documents and sell them. Bland was finally arrested in Florida and extradited to Virginia. All of the stolen maps on the list were recovered, plus about 70 more. Those maps, after a number of years of sending lists around to libraries, were finally abandoned, and those maps that nobody could identify the books from which they came were donated to UVA in 2001. Now, Bland himself, he pleaded guilty to interstate transportation of stolen property, and he was sentenced to 8 months in jail, and he did that, and 3 years probation, and $70,000 was his ordered restitution. Now, what does this tell us? Well, a couple things in terms of what you need to do as a library, and one of those is libraries do check identification, but you really need to ask for two forms of identification. Of course, he could have forged two forms, but it's more unusual to ask for two forms, and that would have helped. Now, also, in terms of the maps themselves that were cut out of the books, this is a difficult situation because you don't want to mark up all your books with little stamps saying, you know, Harvard Library on every map in a book. But had those maps been marked with an identifying feature from the library, then they would have been much easier to identify and return to the appropriate institution. One of the most prolific and productive book thieves in history is Stephen Carey Bloomberg, and he stole things over about 20 years. In a 20-year career, Bloomberg stole about 19,000 volumes from over 300 libraries and museums in 45 states, Canada, and the District of Columbia. He was very busy. Now, the value of these volumes was estimated at the time at $5.3 million. At the end of the case, the FBI had to hire a 40-foot tractor trailer to haul the books away, and it took them years to get these returned to the appropriate libraries, and they did not return all of them. They had to be donated as well. No, they were actually returned to Bloomberg's father. They were not donated to other libraries. In fact, he had such a distinguished career that he's had a book and a very long New Yorker article devoted to him, or Harper's Magazine article. And he's a very special type of thief. He was really driven more by bibliophilia than monetary gain. He never sold anything. Joseph Gilbert Bland sold the maps. He just collected them. And his house was filled with them. He was a cat burglar. He would shimmy into rooms through air conditioning ducts or over cages. To get to Harvard's library, he adopted the persona of one Matthew McGew, a professor at the University of Minnesota. And he doctored a driver's license to demonstrate that that was him. So he was able to secure a staff pass. And one day he entered the Widener Library at Harvard in an overcoat big enough to conceal a pair of horseshoe nail pullers. Those are huge nail pullers. And he removed one of the lock cylinders and replaced it with a blank. And then he took this lock cylinder up to Canada so somebody local wouldn't recognize him, and he had it remastered. And then he put it back so that he had the key to every lock in the library. And then he could, at his leisure, just collect things. And he did. He was ultimately caught by a tip through an informant. He was convicted and sentenced to 71 months and a $200,000 fine for possessing stolen property and interstate transportation of stolen goods. He was clearly determined, he was clearly obsessive, and he was clearly very successful, at least for a time. Again, the lesson here is check the validity of the ID. Make sure you know who your customers are. And then also beware of people who are inappropriately dressed and behaving inappropriately. And this is more of a staffing issue. You need enough staff to actually notice what's going on in your library. And as we know, in many universities and colleges, there may not be enough resources to provide this kind of oversight. Permanent identification labels in these books would have been helpful, too, in terms of returning them. Again, to reiterate that often these crimes are committed by internal personnel, and the theft of the Mozart and Wagner papers from the New York Public Library is a case in point. In 1997, a porter at the library stole letters and manuscripts of Mozart and Wagner that were valued at over $100,000, and these were offered to a dealer in New York. The porter actually went into a locked storage cabinet and took them out of locked storage. So if the dealer had not recognized them as stolen from the New York Public Library and belonging in the library, this theft might not have been recognized for many years, and they would not have been able to catch this person. In any case, when he took these papers to the dealer, he also showed his identification. So when the dealer found out that at least a couple of these pieces had been in a catalog list belonging to New York Public Library, they were able to call the FBI and immediately pick up the porter, and he was charged and convicted of theft. Knowing your support staff clearly is important, and knowing their background and their interests, and having procedures in place to prevent this kind of theft, also very important. Okay, I think I'm going to skip the butler and... The Butler Library, again, this is a theft of rare books. In the 1990s, one Daniel Spiegelman stole approximately $1.3 million worth of books and documents from Columbia. The Columbian librarians noticed that the books were missing and the documents were missing, and they posted the list on a website and they circulated the list. About a year after they went missing, they saw, or a dealer in the Netherlands noted that some of these materials were being sold, and this man, Daniel Spiegelman, was actually picked up in the Netherlands and extradited back into the U.S. to be prosecuted. And he pled guilty. He pleaded guilty also to the theft charges. What's interesting about this is that the judge in the case was so incensed by the fact that somebody would steal their documents, historical documents, that he decreed an especially harsh sentence for this particular theft, for this thief. And Spiegelman served his time, but he didn't apparently learn his lesson from it, because on parole, and a few years later, following his conviction, he was arrested again for trying to sell the rest of the documents from Columbia to a dealer in Connecticut. The dealer recognized the materials, again, from the list that Columbia had posted. And here, this Columbia followed a very good procedure, which is as soon as you notice the theft, you post it. Let people know what's gone missing, because then the dealers will know, and if they find it, it's within their interest and to their benefit to tell the FBI or the local authorities that they picked this up. Maybe 20, 25 years ago, it was considered embarrassing to have a theft from a university library. Somehow, the university librarians were afraid that if they admitted that they had thefts, that donors wouldn't perhaps donate materials to them. But I don't think anybody believes that anymore, and they're very good about reporting thefts and prosecuting people who do this kind of thing. Okay. The other type of thief is more a casual thief. Although this one was planned as well, it was planned. These are not professional thieves who stole from the Special Collections Department at Transylvania University, and this took place just about a year ago. In December 2004, four 20-year-olds entered the Transylvania Library, University Library, after hours, and used a stun gun on the Special Collections librarian, tied her up, put a toboggan on her head, and then stole pencil sketches by John James Audubon, a first edition Charles Darwin Origin of the Species, and two manuscripts from the 14th and 15th century, which you see on the screen. They had done their homework before committing these thefts. In the later plea, they admitted to visiting the library on a number of occasions to scope out the situation and find out, you know, who was who and what was what and where everything was. And they'd also emailed to Christie's Auction House in New York to find out how they could sell the materials in a private sale. In fact, 2 days after the robbery, two of the young men brought the books and sketches to Christie's in New York. And in the process of trying to negotiate a sale, the curator there at Christie's was very suspicious of the whole thing and called the authorities. The four were identified. They were indicted for theft, interstate transportation of stolen property, conspiracy, theft of major artwork, and possession of stolen property. All four pleaded guilty, and they are now awaiting sentencing. In fact, I looked up, they're still awaiting sentencing. It was supposed to be this month, and it will happen fairly soon. But I think they were looking for more information on exactly what that sentence was going to be. Again, here, this is a well-planned theft by students, by young men, one of whom was a student, and others, the three others were locals who knew the institution very well. But probably ID checks and close supervision of people in the library would have given some sort of clue that something was happening. On the other hand, you can't plan for everything, so these things happen, but it's very important to know who your clients are and to get proper identification from them. Historical sites aren't exempt from this either. This is a theft from the Adams National Historic Site in Quincy, Massachusetts. Four books were stolen from this site. a Mendy Bible, a Latin Bible, an English Bible, and a 1785 textbook on fish. This was stolen in November 1996, and all of the books have now been recovered. This happened when the historical site had been closed for the year. And this is a pretty simple case of just sheer force. The thieves took a chainsaw to the front door and saw the front door off, walked in, the four books were sitting on a table, they picked up the four books and left. Fortunately, somebody saw them. So they got the description of the car, and they picked up the thief, Kevin Gilday, and they found two of the books in one Gold's Gym in one town, and they found two more books in another Gold's Gym in a bag in another town, and one of them was slightly damaged by water, so I don't know. Here I'd say, you know, electronic and other security measures are very important in this particular case. Also, professional thieves will take anything that's not nailed down, and you probably don't want to leave valuable books laying on a table in any exposed position, so this is something to think about as well. Here, and this is often the case when we recover materials, it's much easier to steal something than it is to sell it, particularly if a work of art or a manuscript or an important map. It's a very specialized field. And sometimes these casual thieves just don't know how to do that, and it's a little bit easier to pick these things up when they try to sell them to the wrong people. So, in terms of preventative measures, the FBI has a little handout that we can provide for institutions that goes through what you should do to try and prevent theft, which is to say, before a theft occurs, what do you want to do? Catalog everything. Catalogs and photographs are crucial to identifying your materials. If you don't have a catalog entry, you don't have a photograph, it's very hard to identify the thing that we find as the thing that actually belongs to you. You need to review security measures and procedures, and you update authorization levels and access procedures, monitor or escort people. Libraries we like to think of free access, but if you have a lot of very rare and valuable things in your library, you do have to monitor them very carefully. Check employment references. Perform criminal history checks on all employees. Prepare a plan. And then another thing that we provide, a service that we provide at the FBI, the ARC crime team particularly, is that our agents will walk through the institution with a curator or with an administrator, with the security personnel, to do a check to see if all the appropriate guards are in place and procedures are in place. If you're an institution, you want to keep in touch with law enforcement about criminal activity in your neighborhood. And generally, just keep in touch so that they know you're there and you know who they are. Consulting your insurance company is a good thing to do about improving your security, and then making sure your staff is trained in security procedures. Inevitably, a theft occurs. What do? Protect the scene of the crime, call the police, you call the FBI, stolen objects fulfill the criteria for the major artwork, theft and major artwork statute, that is, the object is over 100 years old and over $5,000 of value, or $100,000 in value. And then it can become investigated by the FBI. When a theft occurs, there's a list, identify witnesses, prepare written descriptions, contact your insurance company, complete an incident report. After the theft, evaluate what you learned from this. Upgrade security. Prepare statements for the media. Very important. They're going to ask. Prepare a theft report and photos to circulate. Also very important. And one of the ways that the FBI can help is with our ARC crime team members. The ARC crime team was created in October 2004. We have 18 members. It was created partly in response to the looting of the Baghdad Museum. We realized at that point that it would be necessary to have people who are trained in this kind of investigation. And last January, the team was trained in Philadelphia, and we'll have another training in another few weeks for the entire team members. They go to museums, they meet with dealers, they meet with curators, they meet with archaeologists. In Philadelphia, I was there with the State Department, and we introduced them to the museum curators from the Iraq National Museum. The art crime team members are distributed throughout the country. They have regions that they cover. They both investigate crimes in their area, and they also not coordinate so much as consult with other FBI agents and local police on investigation of cultural property crimes in their areas. The two major statutes, let's go through this very briefly again, major artworks, theft of major artwork statute, people who steal, valued at $5,000 and 100 years old, or over $100,000 if it's a modern piece of art. I also have another element at the FBI, another way of capturing stolen art and returning it, recovering it, and that's the National Stolen Art File. I can put in stolen art pieces into the National Stolen Art File if a police report has been created for it, and it has a value of $2,000, the piece of cultural property has a value of $2,000 or more. It goes into a database, and police agencies, law enforcement agencies worldwide can ask me to search the database for specific pieces. But it is accessible only to law enforcement. We put up theft notices on the FBI website so that some of these at least are accessible to the public. And I must admit, this particular one I got a call on from Florida a few weeks ago. So it does work. People do respond. The other important thing with book theft in particular is to make sure that the national and international professional societies know when something's been stolen, and they disseminate that information as widely as possible. Dealers in general are fairly good about reporting stolen pieces. So, just to review, library security, preparedness and guidelines, liaison with law enforcement, and catalog the collections. Deterrence, be aware of what's going on. And report thefts. These are the internet resources for library thefts. And at that, I guess I can't take questions now. I'll take questions later. But thank you for your attention, and I'll get your questions after the rest of our presenters are done. Thank you. Here. Well, let's close mine. Is that yours? Mysterious.
Yeah, it's mysterious. Okay. Well, my name is Dennis, and I'm a recovering federal employee. Oh, different meeting, sorry. In my prior life as a federal employee, I was a federal prosecutor in the Eastern District of Virginia for 18 years, and during that time I had the opportunity to work on criminal violations, theft of antiquities, cultural items, and heritage resource items. Especially in this area, we have a lot of battlefields where people would steal Civil War artifacts, or museums where people would steal things over 100 years old. We've got a lot of activity in this area. It's ripe for the pickings. I have learned that throughout the years that criminals come in all shapes and sizes and all walks of life. And I'm here today to talk to you about a particular case, the mysterious manuscript cases, which was actually prosecuted by Mike Maroos, an assistant U.S. attorney out in Columbus, Ohio, who wanted to be here today, and he couldn't make it. So because I was able to consult on that case a little bit, he asked me to stand in, and he sent me his PowerPoint, and of course the legend that goes with that I left in the car. So we're going to fake that part and talk a little bit about his case and fill in the facts where I can. This case basically started in a sense, in 1994. So it's kind of an older case that we're talking about, but it has a lot of law enforcement and historical significance. It started in 1994 when the defendant, Anthony Melnikoff, an art history professor at Ohio State University, basically consigned two manuscript pages to an art dealer in Akron, Ohio to sell. He was coming up close to retirement, so he started thinking, well, let me start selling these valuables that I have to enhance my retirement. And at that time, he told this Mr. Farini, the art dealer at the auction house there in Akron, Ohio, he basically said that he obtained these from a print seller in Spain who was using them as dividers in a print bin. And one of them was titled King, Free, and a Slave, and another one was Dog and Man Fighting. And a price tag of between $15,000 and $20,000 for the King, Free, and a Slave was an agreed-upon price that Mr. Farini would advertise that specific page by itself. $15,000 to $20,000 for that one page. Both of the pages had a, this doesn't go back, the first slide there is basically a monk making manuscripts here. And in the time period of the 13th and 14th century when manuscripts were actually made, they are all hand done, and they were basically done on like sheepskin. And you can get like four pages folded in the fashion you see now with all the calligraphy and artwork that they would do on these pages. And that's how they put their manuscripts together. But this was a type of page that Mr. Melnikoff had obtained from a manuscript. And he too used the X-Acto type of process by cutting the pages out of a manuscript. And in one of the two, the dog and man fighting one was actually sold to a collector in Europe and subsequently had to be retrieved from that collector. But both of these pages had shown clear evidence of cutting out of the manuscript itself. And but he took them because he didn't have any reason to disbelieve this world-renowned art history professor. He's known throughout the world for working on treatises and manuscripts and collaborating with different libraries, including the Vatican. And subsequently, the investigation revealed from authorities in Spain that these manuscript pages had actually been stolen from the Cathedral Library in Toledo, Spain, and one in Tortosa, Spain. And the lead for that actually came from the, got to get this one straight now, one group on these folios was from the Princeton, Dr. Merrow from Princeton University was one who helped, and one of his research assistants, discover where they had been taken from, and then Pierpont Morgan Library in the other case. So we have theft from the Vatican, and we have theft from cathedral libraries in Spain. So these were the two pages, as you can see, the cut pages, is how these actually came out. So here, Mr. Franey has these two pages, and he's got them in his auction catalog for sale, actually sells one of them. And about 14 months later, Mr. Melnikoff invites Farini to come be a guest lecturer at his art class, his art history class. So he goes in there and is talking to Mr. Melnikoff, and when Farini obtained these first two Spanish ones, he also says, I have some valuable Italian ones, very important Italian ones I want to show you. So 14 months later, after the class, Farini goes to Melnikoff's house, and Melnikoff shows him the items that had come ultimately from the Vatican Library, which is, there's your Vatican there, and there's the library. These, when Farini is talking to Mr. Melnikoff, then the story started changing again as to where he had obtained the items. One, he would explain that he had obtained them from an unknown prince seller. Then it was, they were part of his wife's inheritance. So he kept changing the story. That got Mr. Ferrini suspicious. So then he went back to his house with the two items, now the Vatican ones, to say, to try and figure out what to do with these, because now he was suspicious that everything he had was stolen. So he contacted customs out there in Ohio. And then through contacts like Bonnie would have, the art history community was basically alerted that we're trying to find out where these pages came from. So basically, the Ferrini provided photos and Xerox copies of, I guess, the two Vatican ones to Dr. James Merrill from Princeton University. It took him about 2 hours to basically tell where those came from, two different manuscripts in the Vatican Library. And ultimately, Father Boyle, who was the head librarian at the Vatican, confirmed that they were stolen from there. And then he came back, Father Boyle said, you know what, we're even missing another page. So by this time, the prosecutor who's been on the case is now executing his second search warrant at Mr. Monocross's house, trying to find this third page. And they, again, at this time, they're interviewing Mr. Monocross, and his story changes again as to where he got them. And then finally, he provided a written statement. And in the written statement, I love this one, he says, as far as I can remember, during one of my visits to the Vatican Library, I found these three leaves of manuscripts loose, and they ended up in my possession in the other paper's research notes. And now that I see edges being with signs of being cut out, it could be that I have done it. Well, quickly he saw the error of his ways after writing that statement, because then he tried to backtrack from even those comments and statements that he had written. So the prosecutor was in a difficult position with this case because, one, he has to authenticate where these items came from. Two, he has to determine how they entered the United States and approximately when. Why is that important to a criminal prosecutor? Well, generally there's a statute of limitations. If I stole one of those pages today, 5 years and one day from now, if I stole it in the United States, I can't be charged with that theft, as theft being the prohibited act. So looking at that from that perspective, the investigation revealed that it was in the 1960s and 1970s that Mr. Monocross was actually in the cathedral libraries in Spain. And the theft of those items occurred back in that time period. And then he had access for all these years at the Vatican Library, since he was working on collaborating on various manuscripts and treatises with them and translations with them. This guy had carte blanche at the Vatican Library. So generally, where the procedure for the library, first to have access to remove any of the photos, first you have to go through their security procedures. And one, you must be a scholar. So as an art history professor, basically chairman of the department out there at Ohio U, well, he fit that, and all of his writings and everything else gave him some credentials. Then he had to demonstrate the need for the resources of the library. Well, the library basically hired him to collaborate on putting some treatises and translations together, and he must demonstrate the need, the reason why the work must be done at the library. Well, it's your paperwork, it's your books, it's your library, let me do it there. Well, after you meet that prerequisite to get in there, then you have to sign in at the front door of the library, a little sign-in log. Then you have to obtain a key for a locker, and you must store all your belongings in that locker. The only thing you can generally take in is your notes or laptop computer. They don't, or maybe some type of little briefcase, but not usually. Then, once you're in the manuscript reading room, you have to place an order for that manuscript, requesting the particular manuscript, and that request is given to an attendant at the large desk in the front of the library. Probably will be in one of these pictures around here somewhere. That's one of the manuscripts, one of the pages was taken out. And then the reading room attendant retrieves that manuscript. He brings it back from an underground visit. Now, these manuscripts are underground in the Vatican. Then the reader has to study the manuscript under the supervision of normally two library staff, one in the front of the room, one in the back of the room. And when the library closes for the day, the reader has to turn in the manuscript to the front desk, but he can request that it be kept at the front desk if he's coming back the next day. That's a great security procedure, except in this particular case, since he was working with the library at their request, and because he was well known around the world, he had carte blanche to the library. So he got to go in the summertime when the library is closed. So they don't have all the security guards monitoring and everything else. And so basically, these pages that he took from the Vatican Library, he took in the summer of 1987. But again, we're dealing with this case, this investigation in 1994, 1995, which means your 5 years statute of limitations have actually passed by for a theft. Plus, the theft was overseas, and the items were brought into the country. So the creative prosecutor had to figure out, what am I going to charge this guy with, and how am I going to charge him? So he's looking at various federal criminal charges. One of them is dealing with the National Stolen Property Act. It's the Title 18 where the main criminal violations of federal law are. And this one dealt with the sections 23, 14, and 15. We call it the National Stolen Property Act case. And it dealt with smuggling, it dealt with interstate transportation over foreign or domestic state lines of items that are at least $5,000 in value. Now again, even that transporting into the country, like with the Spanish items, that was 1960s to 1970s. So by the time this came up, that was 20 years old. So that transportation was long gone. But within that statute, one of the prohibited acts was concealing an item. And concealment is an ongoing crime until it's discovered. And once it's discovered, then that 5-year statute of limitations period starts running from that point on. So then you're dealing with the aspect that they were brought into the country illegally, because you're dealing with stolen property from a foreign country coming here without proper authority, without permission, without the papers. So you have smuggling violations. But again, smuggling is the same thing. 5 years and one day, you can't charge them for the smuggling. But that statute under Title 18, which is in the Section 545, also has concealment as a prohibited act. So we had that to go on, too. So he was looking at those kinds of items and those kinds of statutes when he sent out this global email to all U.S. attorneys' offices saying, hey, this is the kind of case I have, and I'm trying to work with the lawyer, trying to negotiate a global settlement on this case. And when he's working at this global settlement, well, he explains the case, and I'm sitting there thinking, sounds like ARPA to me. Now, I'm an old guy, I'm retired, and I am affiliated with AARP, which is the retired persons thing, okay? But ARPA, from a criminal law standpoint, deals with the Archaeological Resources Protection Act. And it's a statute that passed in 1979, amended in 1988. And its purpose was to protect these archaeological and cultural resources, primarily within the United States, for the preservation of all of us, for us and our kids and everything else. These kinds of cases get great publicity. Great publicity when you get it, because yeah, you'll get a spy case every 4 or 5 years, and that generates publicity, you know, and you'll get drug cases and gun cases. But when you get a case like this, especially a heist from the Vatican, you're going to get worldwide press on these things. And so you get articles and papers and periodicals and everything else, and usually they're pretty good articles. And we like to see that, because we hope that the publication of these things actually helps as a deterrent to people saying, you know, you might get caught, you might not, but if you do, it's a stiffer price than you're willing to pay. So here, that's actually Father Boyle. Now, I think he's now since passed, but he was the librarian. And this is where you would check in and put in your card to get the manuscripts delivered to you right there. And this would be your login book. So we actually were able to tell, they kept all these records from way back at the beginning of the library, that they could tell what days Mongolicos was actually in the library and what books he actually had access to. And from when they did their, basically like bait stamping their books and their pages and everything else, when they did these back for the Spanish libraries and for the Vatican, most of these were done in the 60s and 70s as people were microfishing and doing all these things to make sure they had copies of everything. So they could say when they had the pages, and then when they go back, they say, now we know they're missing because we microfished them and they're not there anymore, and we could show when he was in the library and when and that he actually had access to all of these things. So investigatively, it was when you're dealing with three different governments, basically, and to get the results they did is amazing in this particular case. And those, this is how you get into the library, basically. You have to, the first checkpoint of security is going by the Swiss guards, you know? And they don't really show it. Mike didn't put the slide in here, he forgot. But generally, when you look at the little square box up there to the right, the black box up there, you see that on the right? I don't know how you do it. Just doesn't have a thing. Right above me here, see the black square there? That's basically one of those, when you enter the library, be good type of thing, because if you don't, you know, not only will you be excommunicated, but you're going to go to hell, basically, is kind of what they said. So we always knew that if this case was lost, the Mongolicos would get sentenced by a higher authority, which was pretty good. But so this is kind of the working conditions he would have to work in the Vatican Library there. And it's amazing how somebody would put his name and reputation on the line the way he did in this particular case. That's actually Assistant Chapel. But when you when I heard about this case, I called Mike up. These are the folios from the Spanish Library here. This one is the, I think that's a dog and man fighting. Mm-hmm. And that was the one that was sold to a European collector. And then this is the one the king framed the slaves. This one was valued in the auction book between $15,000 and $20,000. And from your position, you can't really see. But generally in the lower right-hand corner, generally, or left-hand corner on these pages that Mongolicos took, he would they would have these notations, T-O-R or T-O-L, and that was the clue that the research assistant from, I think it was the Pierpont Morgan Library, figured out where these came from the cathedral libraries in Spain, from Fort Tortosa in Toledo, Spain, is how that was determined. So then I called Mike up because I'm dealing with the Archaeological Resources Protection Act. And archaeological resource under the statute is just basically material remains of past human life or activity of archaeological interest at least 100 years old. Well, clearly these were made in the 13th or 14th century, so from that particular standpoint, it met the definition of 100 years old. Now, was it an archaeological resource? And when you look at the pages, you're saying, that's pretty fantastic, and it records history. So that shows it has, scientific interest for your archaeological value and everything. And when you get into the regulations for the statute, it basically gives you a laundry list of items that would be covered as archaeological resources. It's an including but not limited to list. And these items would come under items of symbolic representation. Let me have Dick, what else we got here? There's a couple of categories where it would fit under that laundry list. But basically anything man-made, touched, molded, or anything that's over 100 years old, used, or whatever, would probably fit in the definition of archaeological resource. So I called Mike up and I said, I've been teaching ARPA for 5 or 6 years, and he's sitting there thinking, I'm not interested, and he's, you know, and I'm saying, why not? Because he says, I'm, you know, already having trouble with these other statutes, fighting these motions to throw out the indictments because of violations of the statute of limitations. I said, yeah, but we got him dead to right on ARPA, and, you know, and he's sitting there, it sounds like an old person's case, you know, type of thing. I said, no. And I explained to him that, you know, under ARPA, no person can sell, transport, exchange, purchase, receive an archaeological resource in interstate or foreign commerce, and they cannot now excavate, they cannot sell, purchase, or exchange it in violation of any state or local law, regulation, ordinance, or permit. So, what, you know, he says, what does that mean for me? And I said, well, you have to prove that there's a violation of state or local law. Not that he's convicted of it, that he violated a state or local law with his possession of these items. And so in this particular case, he's possessing stolen property. Was it in the interstate commerce? Well, it was in foreign commerce from Italy or Spain to here, you know, to hit the U.S. border, and then he had to interstate from wherever he landed to get it to Columbus, Ohio. So he was clearly in violation of this aspect. The problem we had now, he says, does this law apply to foreign goods versus U.S. archaeological resources? And I went back to the definition, and I don't think this goes back, does it? Nope. Where is this? This one here? That's back? Okay. It says material names, past human life activity, that kind of thing, over 100 years old. But it doesn't say foreign or domestic under the statute. Clearly, the intent of the statute was mainly to protect U.S. But that's to protect U.S. stuff going out, too. And if we want protection of U.S. items going out of the country, we have to protect other countries' items coming in. And so because it doesn't say foreign or domestic, he says, sounds pretty good, you know? But he didn't come to that conclusion until we took him to the lawyer's training class we had. The other year we were doing a lawyer's class to train him on archaeological resources protection. And this one happened to be in Death Valley. And so we took him out there and we trained him, and we said, the only way we're going to let you go home and not leave you out here in the desert is if you agree to take this as an ARPA case. So he agreed at that point. And with that, he created history in that sense, because this is the first time that the statute had been used in an international context. Normally. Now, you also still had a problem, because as you get closer to pleading, you have situations where the defendants start getting nervous and they keep flip-flopping back or forth. And of course, as long as he's got money to pay the retainers and pay the lawyer's fees, the individual is innocent until indigent. So once we got past that stage, he would be working on the aspects of getting the courage to stand up there and say, yes, I did it, I'm guilty. So time kept pressing on, statute of limitations went out, moving forward with the new violations. And so we have to sit there and say, how do we get them off the dime? And it got to the point where they were setting up for trial, they were getting ready for trial, but that creates a problem. Because now, in any case, any piece of evidence, you have to have a chain of custody. You have to say, yes, there's a manuscript page from the Vatican. Well, who can tell you it came from the Vatican? Somebody with knowledge that it came from the Vatican or from the cathedral libraries in Spain. Well, in this case, there's three people that they could have sent over, only three. One was Cardinal Boyle, who helped on the investigation and actually helped research and find out, yes, the pages were missing. One was the administrative cardinal over him, and the third one's the Pope. Those are the only ones that can talk about chain of custody. Now, the prosecutor was getting nervous because trial time's coming up, and he's sitting there thinking, okay, I need to authenticate these items, and there's only three people that can do it, but our subpoenas are no good across out of the country. They're good anywhere in the country, but not out of the country. He says, what do I do? He says, and the other problem that I have is, I can solve that problem quickly, and I said, how's that? He says, well, next week the Pope's going to be in New York on a visit. And I'm sitting there thinking, as a prosecutor, this is a gem. It's a godsend, because it's like drug cases. Who are your witnesses? Oh, they're drug dealers. You can't say Mother Teresa, the Pope, and God weren't available, and now they don't deal drugs, you know? And here's a case where you could have said to the jury, ladies and gentlemen, this is great. We do have the Pope here today. But, you know, the more I thought about it, I said, you want to serve the Pope with a subpoena in New York for your case? And he says, what are my options? I said, well, depends if you want to keep your job. So it turned out that Mr. Melnikoff eventually joined Team USA and decided to cooperate and plead guilty and solved that problem. Didn't have to worry about the subpoena issue. But eventually, Mr. Melnikoff got sentenced in these cases. And he had the luxury of getting sentenced back in 1966 before the sentencing guidelines were increased in 2002. Because he only had a 14-month jail sentence and a $3,000 fine, and he had to pay do 250 hours of community service, and he had to pay $10,000 to have those folio pages returned, repatriated, and restored back to the Vatican and the cathedral libraries in Spain. Turned out he had volunteers from customs to take the Vatican ones back, and they did. And then for the Spanish ones, they had an elaborate ceremony at the Spanish embassy in Washington, D.C., here, where they returned at that time and got tremendous press at that. So when we're looking at archaeological resources, again, in the regulations, you'll find out that it talks about surface or subsurface structures, it talks about whole or fragmentary tools or containers or weapons, it talks about waste products and organic waste and coprolites, it talks about rock carvings, rock paintings. And again, if you can read that in little section 7 of VII, it talks about other works of artistic or symbolic representation. And that's the category this basically came under for ARPA at that time. The penalties at that time were not as stated here in the statute, because there's another law in the books that make most felonies of this type, property crimes, felony up to, in this case, ARPA's first-time violator, up to 2 years imprisonment, up to $250,000 fine. For a second or subsequent violation for a felony, it'd be up to 5 years in jail and up to $250,000 fine. Now, if you don't know, felony is anything that has jail time exposure over a year. Anything under a year is a misdemeanor in the federal system. If it's under 6 months or less, it's a petty offense. So now there's a movement afoot to try, with the increase in the sentencing guidelines that occurred in 2002, to try and change the statutory maximums for these statutes. So it would now become a 10-year felony for a first offense and 20 for a subsequent offense. They're trying to change the statute of limitations from 5 years to 20 years, much like the theft of major artwork, because these items are bought by private collectors. They go underground. They're on surface until somebody wants something bigger to swap with, or until somebody dies and it surfaces at an estate sale or something like that. So they want the penalties to be out there, so anyone who has knowledge of the crime and concealed it, they can still be punished for withholding this from the rightful owners. So you have that kind of activity going on right now on that. I know Mike also had another case, another professor, a Brayhawk from Kent State, I believe. Oh, Kenyon College, I'm sorry. My apologies to Kent State. Kenyon College Library, and he basically stole 50 books from that library and sold those in interstate commerce. And he, too, is working his way through the federal system right now. He got sentenced, but I'm not quite sure what the sentence was, but he did plead guilty to his violations, too. And most of the people in these cases ultimately plead guilty because most of them don't actually have a defense. They're not an innocent owner. But you will find that in these kinds of cases, as I said, they come from all walks of life, so you might have a drug addict who will go dig up the battlefield to find artifacts to sell so he can supplement his addiction, and then you get to this level where you have people who, for the ego, prestige of owning these items, will buy or sell almost anything. But it is a new thing that law enforcement must start focusing on, because with law enforcement tools being on, in a sense, terrorism, guns, and drugs, you know, art theft is becoming even more prevalent because the lack of law enforcement focus on that. And so if you can get $15,000 or $20,000 for a piece of paper, you know, your chances of getting caught aren't great. You know? And if you're caught, your chance of getting prosecuted is still marginal depending on where you're caught and the training they have. So that probably you will see, if you go through the history of these types of cases, you will see artifacts being put up as collateral for bond in a drug case. You'll see artifacts being used as partial payment in spy cases. You know, and now, is this the new wave of terrorism to support terrorism? By stealing art, by selling art, and artifacts because it's under the radar screen. Yeah. Anyway, I'm done. Yeah.
The good news is I will be brief. I'm Sarah Chapman. I'm an assistant downtown in the U.S. Attorney's Office here in Washington. And unlike my co-panelists, I have no experience in art theft beyond one case that I did this year, which surprisingly our office doesn't have a lot of experience in it either. And what I'm going to talk to you about is the prosecutive decisions that we made in conducting and structuring the investigation in the manner that we did. And then I'm going to turn it over to Kelly Multiotti, who is actually the agent at the archives, who is like the boots on the ground in the investigation, and she'll show you some of the documents that were involved. But basically what happened was, in 2004, I was sitting at my desk, minding my own business, and I was the duty assistant for the fraud section that day, and my phone rang. And it was, on the other end of the line, was a member of the staff at the Inspector General's Office of the National Archives calling to report what was essentially a crime in progress. They had been alerted to the fact that a document from the National Archives was at that very moment being auctioned on eBay. And what could we do about it? And they said something to the effect of, we could always get a replevin action to get the document back. But they felt that they should let us know about that. And my first reaction was, don't recall much about replevin because that was first year of law school, but I think getting things back is not a good idea, so we need to stop this right now. So the first thing that I did was I got on the phone with the general counsel of eBay, and I said, hi, you have a document that's being for sale, and it's actually the stolen property of the National Archives, and about 20 minutes later, that document was off. So that brought us immediately some thought time for how to proceed. And during that time, I got open my code book with the Title 18, and started looking for a statute that had the longest possible statute of limitations, because as other people here have mentioned, that's your number one criteria. And I don't know very much about art law, but I have prosecuted a whole lot of cases and gone to trial on a whole bunch of them, and I needed to get in the door of the courthouse, and I needed to get the grand jury moving on this case so that we could stop things and get the property back as fast as possible. So that's when I came in contact with the Theft of Cultural Resources Act was 18 U.S.C. 668, which other people have mentioned already, and I brought a copy of it for you. It's outside on the table. And what immediately attracted me to this statute was not only the statute of limitations that it had, but it also packs a huge sentencing wallop. So just from a certain practical standpoint, I had two really good things to go with. It had flexibility because it applied to a variety of situations. It applied where something that was more than 100 years old or worth more than $5,000 was stolen from a museum. And it also criminalized not just the stealing, but the possession. So it was an ongoing offense, and so I could reach back a long time for that. So that's how the matter was opened up. And I called Kelly, and I said, this is how we're going to, I think she was the other agent at the time, Bob Westbrook. So I said, we're going on this way. And they said, but we're not sure we're a museum. And so we had some discussion about whether the archives was, in fact, a museum. And interestingly, when I then turned to research the statute in the oncoming days, it turns out that's actually sort of a pitfall of proceeding in that manner. People have actually successfully argued that they were not a museum. And there was a case that actually discusses this out of the Third Circuit called Pritchard, which involved thefts from a sort of home foundation. It was kind of an interesting situation. The family, it was a very old Pennsylvania family that owned a historic home that they'd established a foundation to display their personal collection of antiques and Civil War memorabilia from. And the defendant had stolen a Civil War officer's uniform from this foundation, the Hunt Phelan Foundation. And he moved to dismiss his indictment on the theory that this was not a museum per se, this was just a private family home, so he couldn't be prosecuted. Fortunately, the judge in that case said, no, this clearly has been set up to function as a museum under the appropriate sort of taxing structures of going through a foundation set up, and he allowed the case to go forward. But the Theft of Major Artwork statute was passed in 1996 at the instigation of Senator Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts. And he apparently, according to the legislative history, had actually kind of a specific reason for this. And many of you may remember the theft from the Isabella Gardner Museum in Boston of the Vermeers and Rembrandts that is actually still outstanding. And there's a really fascinating article. I also brought copies for all of you. A sort of Boston Globe expose of how that theft was done and the investigation of that one. But Senator Kennedy offered this statute in order to facilitate the prosecution of those thieves should they eventually be caught, hence the 20 years of looking back. So it's been used, actually, unfortunately, not to prosecute the Gardner thieves, who are still at large, but it was first brought against two employees of the Historical Society of Pennsylvania who stole more than 200 objects. It was a collector named Medford working in conjunction with the custodian of the Philadelphia Historical Society, and they stole objects such as a snuff box that belonged to Alexander Hamilton and some firearms that were had significance to the history of Pennsylvania. So the case that we had, which is actually United States versus Harner, Howard Harner is the defendant in that case, is actually, I think, only the fourth published decision involving 18 U.S.C. 668. And it's that way simply because on one afternoon I had to move extremely quickly to stop the sale of property. And that was the best way to go forward. So sometimes these things work serendipitously. In terms of structuring the investigation, what happened next is after the item was removed from eBay, the next thing that happened is that subpoenas were issued in order to try to trace back the provenance of the document. And in many ways, we were very lucky because this was being sold by an auction firm. So somebody had to consign it. And the person who had consigned it was not exactly as cooperative initially as one might want, although when it came time to try to get his money back, you can bet he was calling me extremely frequently. But Kelly will talk to you more about the chain and the backtracking that was done with this, but starting with this one document and the use of subpoenas to the people that were subsequently held it, we managed to trace back the document to a man named Howard Harner. And then that actually happened relatively quickly in a couple of weeks. And then the next problem that we had was, well, what do we do now? We have a suspect, and how are we going to move this case forward? And the two main ways that one would normally do this are by executing a search warrant to try to go look for more contraband, or you could go and try to interview the target. It's a common law enforcement technique to try to interview them at the same time as you're executing the search warrant, because not only do you kill sort of two birds in one stone, but you can find stuff that you can confront the person with, provided they don't ask you to leave them alone while they get a lawyer. But in this case, we had an interesting problem about developing probable cause, which is that not only did we have this one document which no longer was in Howard Harner's home, but we didn't know whether there would be other documents there, because the archives had made a curatorial choice not to tamper with the integrity of the document by marking it as the property of the National Archives. So it took Kelly a really long time to figure out what was there and what was gone. But she ultimately went down, and she and the FBI agent who were assigned interviewed Mr. Harner, who fortunately confessed to taking the articles from the National Archives, which moved us then to the next stage of the investigation, which took pretty much close to a year, which was valuing what he had taken, which was a lot trickier than it sounds, because there are a variety of ways that one could approach this. And his sentencing guideline range was going to turn on the value of all of the property that he'd taken. And I mentioned before that one of the things that was attractive about 668 was the sentencing package that accompanies it. And when Bonnie was talking, she was mentioning that there were a lot of ITSP cases that she bought. And I didn't want to go that way, although it would have been easier in some respects, and eventually I might have been forced to turn to that if Mr. Harner had given us a problem. But the base offense levels, the sentencing guidelines work by calculating sort of a number that's assigned to how bad your crime is, and then you move along a grid compared to your criminal history. So the base offense level that relates to the severity of your crime was much higher for 668 than it was for a lot. So I wanted to keep that statute. And then we started working on trying to value all of what he took. And we sat there on a lot of sessions trying to figure out what was the best way about that. And we contacted some appraisal firms to think whether should we have it appraised. Was that an appropriate measure of having all of the items valued for sentencing purposes, because the offense level is going to adjust by the value? Or should we do it by the market value that he received for it, or some sort of intermediate price, because these had been moved along in the actual marketplace? And what we resolved to do is that we actually calculated the price, the value of what he'd stolen, which turned out to be over 100 items, by his personal profit, which we traced through subpoenas to his bank records and also customer receipts, because he had paid other people had paid him. And it was kind of a sad case, because it turned out Mr. Harner was an elderly, essentially destitute, unemployed man who had been stealing from the National Archives in order to support himself, and he'd spent the money that he'd gotten for these documents on things like dentures. So it was, it was kind of unusual. This was not one of the ones that Bonnie was talking about where somebody is in it for gain. And he also was a real Civil War buff. He collected this stuff. It was very important to him. He was a relic hunter. And so in figuring out how we should approach this, it seemed appropriate to us to look at his personal gain rather than the commercial value of what he stole, although one could debate all day long whether one should look the other way. Had we approached it from the commercial value of what he stole, Mr. Harner would certainly die in jail. He would be looking at way over 10 years. and that is a, I think, a significant recognition by Congress that this is an important crime, and it's now given prosecutors the tools to seek enhanced penalties and courts the authority to impose sentences that actually reflect the loss to society that the theft of these items represents. Mr. Harner, looking just at what the value of what he received, he wound up with a sentence of 24 months. And that's a significant sentence for somebody who has no criminal history, so to speak, of. And it also, I think, serves the government's purpose in bringing this prosecution, because it's an important deterrent effect. 2 years in jail is not anything that most people are going to willingly take the risk to do. So I will now turn it over to Kelly to talk about exactly what she did and what she looked at, but thank you.
I'm Kelly Maltagliotti, Special Agent with the National Archives and Records Administration Office and Inspector General. I came to the archives and I was just coming off of a trial on bomb-sniffing dogs that didn't sniff explosives. And I quickly had to shift gears, like you'll learn how to do as an attorney. As an investigator, we have to do the same thing. And I came to the archives and I was there about 3 months, and Sandy Berger came to visit us. And about 6 months later, Mr. Harner, we discovered he had stolen documents. And I wish I had some humorous stories to tell you in the Civil War case, like I did with Sandy Berger, where he left the courtroom with the original signed plea agreement. It's a true story, he did. I'm trying to get into the nuts and bolts of this investigation. It started in April of 2004. An NARA employee received an email from a researcher named Wayne Mott up in Gettysburg, and he had seen the document on eBay and recognized it as one that he had actually seen in the National Archives. Mr. Mott did a biography on General Louis Armstead, and so he was familiar with every document that Mr. Armstead was associated with. This is General Armstead. General Armstead is famous for leading Pickett's Charge, and usually you'll see a picture of him with a hat on a sword and running down the field, and he died from wounds that day. This is one of the documents, I'm sorry it's hard to see, but this is one of the documents that Louis Armstead wrote, and that was sold for $40,000. Mr. Mott was very helpful. This is the kind of person you need in these investigations. He sent over all the documents he had concerning Mr. General Armstead, and luckily what they had on them was a slug from the National Archives saying reproduced at the National Archives, therefore showing that the documents had been in our possession. The archivist immediately, once the documents were removed from eBay, the archivist immediately began trying to determine where this document came from. And they found it in a record group containing the U.S. Army Continental Command and narrowed it down to what we call Box 17. Not being familiar with researching or the archives that much, I quickly went down with the other agent and we familiarized ourselves and got to know the archivist and how the stacks worked in the research room. And like Dennis mentioned, when a researcher comes in, they look at our finding aids to determine where the documents are that they want, and then they determine the record group they want. Sometimes there's an entry, and it goes all the way down to a box, and they fill out a researcher slip. And this is given to the person in the research room, and then they go and retrieve the documents, the box of documents, and bring them back. And one thing the archives really has going for them is they keep these documents, the farthest I've found is at least for 30 years. And so these are very good evidence. Like Dennis mentioned, you can find out who was in what box when. Not specifically what document they were looking at, but at least that they were in that box. And the stacks at the archives are incredible. If you ever get a chance to go see them, it's somewhere the murder mystery should take place. It's just very interesting to me when I came to the archives to learn all these things. At the same time that the archivists were looking at these pearl slips, we began contacting the auction house with the information that Sarah got from the subpoena, and we started tracking back what we call the provenance of the document and contacting the person who bought it from this person, who bought it from this person, and we ended up going back through five different people for this first document until we got to a man named James Petries, and he purchased it from Howard Harner. And I don't know whether it was instinct or luck or whatever, but we stopped at that point. And at the same time, the archivist came back to us and brought us eight pull slips for people who had been in Box 17, and Mr. Harner had been one of those individuals. I was very lucky at the FBI. The agent that they assigned was a former history teacher, so she was very interested in this case. And we often work the cases with the FBI. We have a very small office that covers the nation, and so we have to get resources, and the FBI is a very good resource. Well, by the time we had reached out to these five different owners of this document, the collector's community was abuzz, and even though we asked them not to talk about it, the word got back to Mr. Harner. Unfortunately, he called to confess, so we didn't have to go out there and try any of our great tactics. And as Sarah mentioned, he was a recluse who was in his late 60s, a relic hunter, who could have easily walked right into a Civil War reenactment without any makeup. He initially sold the documents, one through the internet with someone's help, and about half a dozen through an auction house in the late 1990s. And then in 2000, he met James Petries, who lived about, we found out later, about a mile away from Mr. Harner. And he thought Mr. Petries was just a collector. So he felt very comfortable selling the documents to him, thinking that they would not get out into the community. However, Mr. Petries had his own bills to pay, so he began selling these documents. And they began appearing over the internet and in auction catalogs. And at one point, Mr. Harner received an auction catalog. And this is very unusual because he didn't have the money to subscribe to these things. And when he was flipping through it, he saw a document that he stole from the archives. And he later told me that he thought I sent him the catalog to prompt him to confess. So you never know how lucky you're going to get. As Sarah mentioned, we needed the collector's help and the dealers in this realm to find these documents and track them down. And some were more helpful than others. We got to one point with one of them. I called Sarah. I said, I think we have to do a seizure warrant because this guy won't turn over the document. I mean, you know, I told him, I said, you're in possession of stolen property. I tried everything I could to threaten him, and he wasn't turning it over. But the problem is when you call these people and you say, hey, you've got a stolen document, you know, you need to return it to the archives, they're like, well, prove to us that it came out of the archives. And then again, they're out of money. They go to the person who they purchased it from and ask for their money back. And it's a very reputable industry. I guess everybody pretty much pays someone back when there's a stolen document. And they all ended up going back to Mr. Harner, who had no money. And luckily, we probably would have had to fight for the document. It cost $40,000, but it was at a university, so they were very cooperative. And it's been mentioned several times, the archives does not keep an item-level inventory. They never have, and they never will. And one thing that was lucky about these Civil War documents is that there were correspondence registers from the Civil War era that were created at that time, documenting when letters were received and sent. And so we had these great volumes where we could track the documents and show they came in and were turned over to the archives, you know, 100 years ago or whatever, and that they weren't supposed to go anywhere else. So between using the registers that we had, the pull slips, and the documents that Wayne Motz provided, even though it was only for one Civil War general, that would have been the evidence we used had we gone to trial. The archivists are very unique people. They treat these documents as their children. I mean, I had to hold several of them back from Mr. Harner. These people are so devoted to what they do. I had a case last month where someone threw documents in the trash, and I had archivists suit up in hazardous suits and go into a trash compactor where trash had been there for a week and search out the documents, and I never heard a complaint from them. They began researching all the boxes. It's all the pull slips that Howard Harner had filled out when he was there, and they started researching all the boxes he had accessed, and then went through the registers to determine what documents should have been in there and what documents were now missing. We found out that there were over 100 documents missing. Mr. Harner couldn't believe he had taken that many, but as we talked to him, he talked about how many he would take on different visits. And, you know, at one point he told us the most he ever taken was 7 in total. Well, later on he started remembering that at one visit he took 7. He also had 25 originals still in his possession that he returned to us. And Mr. Pepperidge had about a half a dozen of them that he returned to us. Researchers are very meticulous about their notes, too. Mr. Waymott kept very good notes, and so did Mr. Harner. And Mr. Harner had actually annotated in his notes documents that he had taken from the archives. So that was very helpful, and that we would have used that in trial. I have to tell you, it was, to me, not having been at the archives before, it was very thrilling to see these documents. They're 140, 150 years old. When I first got them, I didn't want to touch them. I didn't know what to do with them. And now I've been educated a little bit on how to handle these to get them to the archivist so that I don't damage them. These are a couple of pictures I brought with you. We got back some documents from Gerald Custer and General Pleasanton. This is a telegraph from General Custer. George, take it. And one of the documents that he authored. And these become more valuable as you can see the whole handwriting is by the individual. A lot of times they would have somebody else write the document and they would sign it, but it's more valuable when the whole document is authored by the individual. And William Tecumseh Sherman's documents were there too. Mr. Harner said he removed documents by using distraction and sleight of hand and folding them up and kind of palming the documents and putting it in his pocket. But what was very interesting is when we got all the documents back and had laid them out and I was returning them to the archivist, I noticed that there was a trifold that had the archives back in the Civil War where they trifolded them and made them into a little folder. But I never noticed any other folds. So I don't know if that's really how he removed them. And he also used the X-Acto knife, actually on the photocopy machine, he said, and cut out signatures. And these are very hard things to find. I found one on the internet actually, and it was Armstead's signature, and I was able to take that signature and compare it to the documents that Wayne Moss had provided the copies and do a match. And we also had the letter where the signature was cut out of that Harner returned back, and the FBI was able to do a match to show it came from that document. Now the repair work has to be done. We also got back some signatures with no documents. I don't know where those get filed. But in March 2005, Mr. Harner pled guilty. And in April, we searched his home as part of the plea agreement. Since we couldn't do the search warrant, he agreed for us to search his home. And one of the things about this is going down into his basement. And on the second shelf there, I found some copies of documents that he had stolen. And so, I mean, you never know where somebody's going to hide these things in their house. And this is just, I think Sarah has even seen this before. We tried to explain to her how bad his house was.
I didn't want
to
know.
This is the basement, and there were actually documents in the basement. We did not find any original documents from the archives, but we did find numerous rare books from the University of Virginia. I guess they're a popular place to steal from, I'm finding out today. And luckily they had a nameplate in the book, so we were able to identify that. And Sarah mentioned he was sentenced to 2 years. And the judge noted the need for a strong sentence to deter future theft from the archives and to reflect the seriousness of the crime. And Sarah did a great job. She was commended by the archives for her presentation that she did in court. And she gestured to the archivist that came to the hearing. And during the remarks, the judge acknowledged the presence of the employees and coming forward to show how seriously they felt about the documents being stolen from there. And this case was prosecuted 13 months from the day it was discovered, which we thought was pretty well done, and give that credit to Sarah.
All right.
Now I'd like to invite you to ask questions of any of the panelists. I'm sure you must have them. And after questions, I'd like to invite you outside where there is something for us to eat and drink, I guess. But please, what are your questions? Or comments or more other stories even? Yes, in the back.
Yeah, you addressed a little bit about how we can go after people like this for breaking U.S. laws. Was there any thought when they had stolen articles from, you know, the Vatican or other places about using laws in those countries to prosecute, you know, those type of folks?
The problem you have is you can't enforce foreign laws in the United States. So unless you have a specific treaty that spells out conduct that's prohibited or whatever, or one of those MLATs, mutual legal assistance treaties, or other type of, or if you're a signatory to like a UNESCO convention type process, if you don't have those to work with, they're not going to enforce that country's laws absent something directly with the United States on those. So, and we've had that problem on other types of smuggling cases of artifacts to Guatemala and Peru, and from there to the Inca stuff coming up here.
Except Schultz.
But, I mean, you have it, but you prosecute it under, like, you prosecute it using federal laws, and you use those foreign laws to indicate that they didn't have the right of possession type of thing. They didn't have authority. But you would still need somebody from that company, from that country, to say they don't have authority to have it. But you'd still be using U.S. laws or treaties that we're a signatory to.
So there were no requests, for instance, to extradite somebody or a person who often goes to the Vatican?
The Italians wanted to take him overseas. And that was probably part of the plea agreement that that would not happen if he got jail time here, type of thing.
Other questions, comments? Yes.
Following on that international theme, how does your cooperation proceed with other governments or other law enforcement agencies? Does it sound like there's a tremendous international
sure.
aspect where
there are.
The document disappears somewhere else and comes back.
It comes back, or it's stolen overseas, it appears in the U.S., it's stolen in the U.S., it turns up overseas somewhere. The mutual legal assistance treaties are very helpful in coordinating cooperation between U.S. law enforcement and law enforcement overseas. Interpol is very good in facilitating communication about things that are stolen somewhere else and found here, or stolen here and found overseas. Those are the two major ways that we would conduct business on an international basis.
Is there any, does technology or digital technology provide you with any better ways of preventing or detecting this kind of thing or tracing it?
It certainly makes communication faster. Everything's on the web. So you can be in Germany and you can put up a document or a book or an artifact that's been stolen in, I don't know, Guatemala. And somebody in Guatemala will see it. Somebody in Germany will buy it and they'll send it to the United States and it'll go to auction here and somebody else will see it. You know, because so many transactions are now on the web, I think in some respects it makes it easier to identify them. To identify pieces that have been stolen.
On the other hand, you have the other situation where it's easier to make duplicates,
yes,
forgeries, you know, with laser technology and stuff too. So, I think law enforcement has a tough road when you have those situations on authenticating items that way.
There was actually, I saw this in a case that I was reading, to prepare for this, actually, somebody actually tried that as a defense. The man literally took the stand and said, I created this, actually, in my own home. And, you know, he lost because he didn't have enough corroboration for his testimony, but his defense was, it's a fake, you know, I'm in the the business of ripping people off, but I didn't rip these people off, which, believe it or not, actually can work for you sometimes. But in this case, it didn't work out so well for him because only one other person was able to say that they'd ever seen him with, like, a paintbrush. So it didn't sound particularly convincing.
The case that you talked about
with
the individual had 20,000 votes or something like that over the course of his career accumulated.
I don't really know. I think that he was a real collector, so I don't think he had multiple copies of books. I think he really was looking for specific topics in specific books, but I haven't ever really seen the catalog, so I couldn't say for sure.
I hate to keep on hammering away at this international aspect, but we are in an international law school here, so that's probably where the questions are arising. But one of the questions that's been posited by a professor I had was that New York is the place to sell stolen artwork because the laws of New York and of the United States are considerably laxer than they are in other countries. And I was wondering if you could, you know, kind of respond to that statement.
New York is a major market for artwork because of the auction houses, because of the galleries, because of the museums, because of the expertise. So as a major marketplace for legitimate art, often you find illicit art there as well. Is this a product of U.S. law? I'm not sure. We do not regulate the art market in the U.S. as much as it is regulated in other countries in Europe or in Asia, for example. We're a free market country. We don't try not to regulate business at all, if you can help. So the art market is not regulated. We don't demand that they keep registers of works of art. We don't have laws that require export certificates for cultural patrimony. As many European countries do in that sense. But we do have stiff national stolen property law, interstate transportation of stolen property, wire fraud, things like that, where if a country has a piece of stolen property that's being sold in New York and they can demonstrate that it's been stolen, then through these various treaty mechanisms, we can attempt to seize that and return it to them.
I was just going to add to that. The situation with New York is that New York is no less harsh on crime. The situation is that New York has major museums that are looking to display art and have international shows. And if bringing paintings to the United States means that once that painting arrives on the docks in Manhattan, it's going to then be impounded because there is a claim on it that it is Nazi provenance, you know, that it was made in Europe prior to 1945 and obtained sometime between, 35 and 45. And so New York was concerned that if they didn't have some local statutes to protect commerce and protect the ability of museums to stage major collections of international art, that you would never again see a Cezanne on display at the Met as part of a show collected from international owners. And so in that sense, it gives the appearance that they are lax on crime. But then if you look at the cases that have been brought, the cases involving Nazi provenance and the claims of descendants of those who perished during the Second World War, you'll find that many of those cases are brought in New York, and that New York is one of those states that we look to that has a wealth of art law cases and ownership claims being resolved. So let us not castigate New York too soundly. We don't in this country, except in very small circumstances, have what they acknowledge in Europe, and that is the innocent owner, the bona fide purchaser for value. Here we acknowledge that if it was stolen in the first instance, it remains stolen property, regardless of whether the individual who possesses it at the time is complicit in that theft.
Just to back Sherry up a little bit too, the enforcement can be through the criminal process or the civil process. And I know New York clearly leads the way in the civil process for enforcing the law and returning items that are stolen. And they make inroads on the criminal path too. But everywhere can do better.
Mm-hmm. I think there's also one thing to keep in mind is that these are really, really tough cases to prove. There are so many tiny little links in the chain that you don't even really think about. And you always have, whenever you're preparing your case with an eye towards how would it go in front of a jury, you were talking a little bit about, just the authentication problems. We had some of those same issues too. We would have had to, were we going to trial, get somebody to find beyond a reasonable doubt that a lot of circumstantial evidence proved that this stuff originally was in the archives. I think the spirit is willing, but you have to acknowledge that it can be, there are a lot of rules of evidence and a lot of, safeguards that we have built into our criminal code that make us a fabulous country in many ways, but can tie your hands when it comes to actually, prosecuting everything that you really believe is a crime.
The other problem with Sarah just said was, in a criminal standpoint too, like for ARPA or sometimes the theft of museum artwork, where age is a requirement, has to be over 100 years old. How do you prove that sometimes? Sometimes you need to do forensic testing on items. That is very costly to do forensic testing, but also, are you willing to destroy some of that same item? If it is for real versus a forgery or whatever in the testing process. So those are some of the considerations that you have to work through also at those times. And one of the ways we do that is we tell the defendant that every dollar we spend on forensic testing goes to value determinations, and value determinations are what generate the jail time. So we tell them it's not a matter of guilt or innocence, it's a math problem, how much jail time you're prepared to serve. And hopefully they see the light of day and save you from going through that time and expense.
And it is expensive in terms of valuing the harder documents. We had one it's not really hilarious day, but where I was on the phone with various appraisals trying to see if I could get a pro bono job because this was going to cost us $12,000. And, Kelly doesn't have the budget. I don't have the budget, and the FBI said, what money? We're out looking for Osama bin Laden. So, while there were plenty of reasons to justify the valuation approach that we took, the fact that, the defendant was never going to pay us back, he had no money, he had no assets that I could forfeit, realistically, where was this going to happen, So I'm on the phone with, the head of appraisals at Christie's saying, hi, could you do me a favor? And they were like, no, and then Kelly found another person who was, willing to do this, but was hardly an appraisal expert, so then I've got to worry about, that evidence coming in at trial. I didn't know I could qualify the person who was just kind of generally pretty smart, there are a lot of practical problems to go in for. Anything else? Okay, well then why don't we thank our panelists and we can adjourn outside. Thank you.